disguise their digital footprints. And 91% of them agree that consumers have lost control of the way their personal information is used by companies. As with the big three American automakers in 1965, it's increasingly clear that today's big data internet companies are unsafe at any speed. Nothing, 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 and then something dramatic is how you'll remember Union Square Ventures' Brad Burnham describes significant economic or technological change. It happened with food and cars, and it will eventually be triggered in the data economy too by a combination of innovators like Mark Alhamiz and regulators like Margrethe Vestager. As Mozilla's Donnell Dixon Thayer reminds us, surveillance ultimately isn't a good business model. And if there's one thing history teaches us, it's that bad business models eventually die. Chapter 8. Social Responsibility. A View from Nowhen. Sometimes the future shows up in the oldest of places. I'm having lunch with Hugh Price, the Bertrand Russell Professor of Philosophy at Cambridge University, and the co-founder, with Jan Tallinn and Martin Rees, of Cambridge's Center for the Study of Existential Risk. We are sitting in Trinity Hall, the 17th-century communal dining room of the Cambridge College that was founded by the Tudor monarch Henry VIII, the absolutist ruler, who ordered the execution of his former chancellor, Thomas More, after More refused to countenance the legality of Henry's divorce from his first wife, Catherine of Aragon. It's the most famous and wealthiest college in Cambridge, Price tells me, not without a hint of pride about Trinity, where he is a fellow. Over the last 500 years, Trinity has been one of the world's most exclusive and powerful clubs, educating generation after generation of elites, including the inventor of the theory of gravity, Sir Isaac Newton, the father of empiricism, Francis Bacon, 31 Nobel Prize-winning scientists, British monarchs and prime ministers, and even the current Singapore prime minister, Lee Hsien Loong, who was awarded a mathematics and computer science degree from Trinity in 1974. Price, a gangly, down-to-earth Australian, whose only ornamentation is an expensive-looking timepiece wrapped around his wrist, is a most gracious host. As we eat our fresh poached salmon and salad in the historic hall, we talk about the potential dangers of artificial intelligence and our moral duty to manage this new technology responsibly. The hall is an odd place for thinking about the future. Sitting opposite each other on antique pews in the cavernous dining room, we are enveloped by the past. It is a dizzyingly historical picture. Behind us hangs a late 16th-century copy of Hans Holbein's life-size painting of a swaggering, vainglorious Henry VIII, all barrel chest, spread legs, sinuous calves, and clenched fists, which was originally completed in 1537 to celebrate the birth of the king's long-awaited first son, Edward. Holbein is the same Renaissance artist you'll remember, who not only painted the best-known portrait of Sir Thomas More, but also probably drew the map of Utopia for More's little book. Just as the hall is an incongruous place to be contemplating the future, so Hugh Price, who first met Jan Tallinn at a conference about the science of time on a Baltic cruise ship, is a strange person to ask about it. That's because, as a philosopher at least, Price is skeptical about the very idea of time. Borrowing from Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity, Price is a proponent of the block universe theory, which suggests that time itself might be what he calls an anthropocentric idea. Physics has no sense of past or future, Price argues, and so time, that seemingly inevitable stream of moments we intuitively assume that always links yesterday and today with tomorrow, is an illusion. There's no difference between the past, the present, and the future, Price explains. It's a mistake to think of the future as open. As I chew on my poached salmon, I nod politely. If time doesn't exist, I wonder to myself, then why is he wearing such a fancy-looking wristwatch? In all seriousness, however, the block universe idea might not be quite as scientifically far-fetched as it sounds.
Price quotes Albert Einstein's letter to the family of a friend who had just died.
"For those of us who believe in physics," Einstein consoled the grieving family, "the distinction between past, present, and future is only a stubbornly persistent illusion." Whether or not it's scientifically conceivable, this theory certainly has the most deliciously surreal implications. In his best-known philosophical treatise, Time's Arrow and Archimedes' Point, Price suggests that time's arrow, the direction of time, could just as easily be moving backward as forward. He thus presents the seemingly absurd idea of backward causation as a perfectly logical scientific truth. If Price's arguments are correct, and time does, indeed, travel backward, then he and I, by eating lunch together, in what I wistfully described as the metaphysical hall, with its hallowed air, might in fact be the historic ones influencing the Reformation, the Renaissance, and the Enlightenment. If time's arrow really is directed backward, then nostalgia for tomorrow would be entirely logical. Jaron Lanier certainly wouldn't be the only person who missed the future. Just as the classical Greek mathematician, Archimedes, called for a vantage point in the universe, the so-called Archimedes point, to be able to objectively examine the physical world, a view from nowhere, as one contemporary philosopher put it, so Price believes that physicists and philosophers need to establish a similarly authoritative place, a point outside time, where we can think about the temporal world. He describes this place, where there is no yesterday, today, or tomorrow, as a view from nowhen. But Price himself, at least in his life outside of philosophy, is no closer to this view from nowhen than any other temporally constrained person. He divides his own scarce time equally between his Cambridge professorship, the best job in the world, he confides, and his work trying to fix the future. As the academic director of both the Center for the Study of Existential Risk and another prominent new Cambridge institute, the Leverhulme Center for the Future of Intelligence, Price is a key player on Team Human. The purpose of his two research institutes is to investigate the future before it happens. Price's institutes are hiring some of our best scientific researchers to determine the impact of new technology, particularly artificial intelligence, on society. "Why worry about the future?" I ask. "What motivates you to make the world a better place?" It's time, in fact, that triggered his concerns about the future. Time that launched his own mission to make the world a better place. In 2011, Price explains, he became a first-time grandparent of a baby girl born in Sydney, Australia. "For the first time in my life," he confesses, "I realized that there were people I cared about who would be around at the end of the 21st century." Price tells me that he wanted to do something useful and practical with part of his life. In his role as director of these research centers, he sees himself as a startup kind of guy, a facilitator of talent, what he calls a builder of human networks for the 21st century. This pragmatic approach is his way of trying to change things, of doing his duty, of leaving the world in better shape for his granddaughter. It's his version of Moore's Law. Like Jan Tullin, he believes that smart machines are a potential menace, what the Australian philosopher colorfully describes as a whole new demon to our species. He worries about the massive amount of money, $6 billion alone between 2014 and 2016, pouring into artificial intelligence startups, particularly given that small advances in the technology can create billions of dollars of value. But philosophy, particularly ethics, is never far from Price's mind. So he tells me that it's very important for venture capitalists to use moral criteria to determine their investments in the AI space. These kinds of ethical human judgments are critical, he says, if we are to maintain our control over smart machines. Yet for all his concerns about the demonic potential of artificial intelligence, Price isn't entirely pessimistic about the future. He is encouraged, for example, by what he describes as the ethical maturity of the three co-founders of DeepMind, particularly Demis Hassabis, its young, Cambridge-educated CEO. This is the London-based tech company whose investors include Jan Tullin and Elon Musk, a startup founded in 2011 and then acquired by Google for $500 million in 2014. DeepMind made the headlines in March 2016, when AlphaGo, its specially designed algorithm, defeated a South Korean world champion Go player in this 5,500-year-old Chinese board game, the oldest and one of the most complex games ever invented by humans. But in addition to the commercial development of artificial intelligence, Price explains, the DeepMind founders, with other big tech companies like Microsoft, Facebook, IBM, and Amazon, are helping engineer an industry-wide moral code about smart technology. This self-policing initiative, known rather awkwardly as the Partnership on Artificial Intelligence to Benefit People and Society, was formally launched in September 2016. Its goal is to make the world a better place. Trust us, the companies in this alliance say, promising a laundry list of feel-good issues including ethics, fairness, and inclusivity, transparency, privacy, and interoperability, collaboration between people and AI systems, and the trustworthiness, reliability, and robustness of the technology. Trust us with your future, they are saying. Trust us is indeed becoming a familiar promise from the tech community. The self-policing strategy of the DeepMind Coalition sounds similar to the goals of another idealistic Elon Musk startup, OpenAI, a Silicon Valley-based non-profit research company focused on the promotion of an open-source platform for artificial intelligence technology. Musk co-founded OpenAI with Sam Altman, the 31-year-old CEO of Y Combinator, Silicon Valley's most successful seed investment fund. Launched in 2015, with $1 billion raised by Silicon Valley royalty, including the multi-billionaires Reid Hoffman and Peter Thiel, the Silicon Valley-based OpenAI is run by a former Google expert on machine learning and staffed with an all-star team of computer scientists cherry-picked from top big tech firms. What a time to be alive, Altman says about a networked age in which what he calls the merge of humans and smart machines is actually happening. Even our data-rich smartphones, he warns of this imminent singularity, already control us. We are thus faced with a stark existential choice, he believes. Any version without a merge will have conflict. We enslave the AI, or it enslaves us. The full-on crazy version of the merge is we get our brains uploaded into the cloud. I'd love that. We need to level up humans, because our descendants will either conquer the galaxy or extinguish consciousness in the universe forever, he says, presenting this superintelligence threat as if it's the plotline of a Star Trek episode. I ask Price what these young entrepreneurs, fabulously wealthy and gifted technologists, like DeepMind's Demis Hassabis or Y Combinator's Sam Altman, need to incorporate into their self-prescribed moral code. What, I wonder, should the new men of the 21st century be thinking about to ensure that his Australian granddaughter will actually get to see the dawn of the 22nd century? From where are these moral criteria going to come? I want to know. How can we be confident that these new masters of the universe are actually working on behalf of people with the interests of society in mind? For a moment, Price reverses his identity, shifting from startup guy back to being the Bertrand Russell Professor of Philosophy at Cambridge University. He reminds me of the core ethical principle of the Enlightenment, the categorical imperative of the 18th century Prussian philosopher Immanuel Kant. A man of such regular temporal habits, it is said that the people of the city of Königsberg would set their watches by his lunchtime stroll. Kant reminds us that with agency comes responsibility, Price explains. Kant's association of agency and responsibility is the Enlightenment version of Moore's Law, and the moral companion to Stephen Wolfram's and Ada Lovelace's definition of what it means to be human. Having agency, possessing goals, originating things means also being able to intuitively distinguish between right and wrong. And so being human, according to Kant, in spite of what you'll remember he called humanity's crookedness, means naturally doing good, irrespective of who benefits from these actions. And though he's too self-effacing to make this point, Hugh Price himself, by choosing to run his two Cambridge institutes in the public interest, could be a living example of this Kantian model of the responsible citizen.
Super citizens. It would, of course, be wonderful if everyone in big tech were a moral philosopher like Hugh Price. Indeed, if that were the case, there would be no need for this book, since the philosopher kings of Silicon Valley would, civic algorithm by civic algorithm, be automatically fixing the future. Such an idea was the premise of the first and most influential of all imaginary societies, Plato's Republic, and it's been the subject of many of them ever since, including More's Utopia, the imaginary island that Hans Holbein represented as a skull.
Memento mori, respice poste, hominem te esse memento.
The Roman slaves would yell at the victorious general when he was returning from battle. Yes, you will die, but until then, remember, you are a man. In a sense, Hugh Price's block universe theory of time is correct. Nothing ever really changes. Moore's law, with its insistence on our duty to our community, was as relevant in classical antiquity, 16th century England, and 19th century America, as it is today. The challenge, as it's always been, is convincing the kind of elites who attend Trinity College that with great power comes equally great responsibility. This is a particular problem in Silicon Valley, the center of power in our networked age. As I write this, in late June 2017, the tech community is once again embroiled in a series of scandals over its disgraceful treatment of women, with two high-profile investors, Dave McClure of 500 Startups and Justin Caldbeck of Binary Capital, forced to step down because of their persistent and well-documented attempts to sexually assault female entrepreneurs. Earlier this month, Travis Kalanick, the co-founder and CEO of Uber, was forced to resign because of a long history of ethical controversies at the ride-sharing company in everything from rampant sexual harassment of its female engineers to threatening tech journalists to spying on its customers. What is most interesting is that Silicon Valley remains in a cognitive bubble, reluctant to engage with legitimate public worries over monopoly, privacy, and tech-related job disruption, not to mention its own culture. The Financial Times' Rana Foruhar wrote in July 2017 in response to this latest round of Silicon Valley scandals. So, yes, it's certainly not bad news that three of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, Facebook, Amazon, and Google, have joined a self-policing alliance of big tech companies committed to ethics, fairness, and inclusivity in the development of AI products. But how much self-imposed morality can we really expect from multi-hundred-billion-dollar companies that are currently accused of a raft of unethical behavior around the world, including monopolistic market practices, exploitation of their users' data, and failure to pay their local taxes, not to mention the myriad other ethical scandals perpetually engulfing big tech? Although these companies are by no means intrinsically bad, they remain profit-driven businesses, answerable only to their shareholders or investors. Whatever seductive promises their "don't be evil"-style slogans make, there is no such thing as a moral-for-profit company, inside or outside Silicon Valley. For better or worse, the aim of these private superpowers is to dominate markets, not share them. Their goal is their bottom line, not ethics. And yes, it's also encouraging that powerful Silicon Valley investors like Elon Musk, Reid Hoffman, and Peter Thiel have contributed significant capital to an open-source AI platform that, we are promised, won't be owned or operated by a single data silo. But I'm afraid there aren't too many people in Silicon Valley quite as responsible as LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman, a relative paragon of civic virtue, who, during the 2016 American presidential election,
promised to donate $5 million of his own money to a veterans charity if Donald Trump publicly disclosed his taxes. In spite of being an investor in OpenAI, Reid Hoffman is skeptical of hubristic Silicon Valley companies that believe they can stand outside history and fix the entire world. Rather than being courageous, he suggests that's just myopic, even juvenile. "It's great they are being ambitious," Hoffman told The New Yorker about Sam Altman and some of his Y Combinator projects, "but classically in the Valley, when people try to reinvent an area, it ends badly." Hoffman's ambivalence about the grandiose promises of OpenAI may be one reason why he is also one of the major investors in the Fund for Artificial Intelligence and Society, launched by the nonprofit Knight Foundation in early 2017. This fund, which also includes the MIT Media Lab and the Berkman Center at Harvard as partners, and you'll remember BetaWorks' John Borthwick as an advisor, is designed, like the Center for the Study of Existential Risk at Cambridge, to foster a combinatorial network of researchers, ethicists, and technologists focused on studying the impact of AI on society. In contrast with the DeepMind, or Open AI Coalition, this Knight Foundation initiative doesn't just rely on technologists to make ethical decisions. "My point of view is that it is a massive transformation and does really impact the future of humanity," Hoffman says about the AI revolution. "But that we can steer it more toward utopia rather than dystopia with intelligence and diligence." John Bracken, a longtime nonprofit executive who runs the Knight Foundation program, told me that Hoffman is a particularly important influence on this new fund. "We trust Reid Hoffman," Bracken, who has worked with Hoffman in the past, said to me. "We trust him to know that with agency comes responsibility." So what about the ethics of Big Tech's other multi-billionaires? The Cooks, Zuckerbergs, Benioffs, Bezoses, Pages, and Brins? None, of course, are as immature as Travis Kalanick. Nor are they as Kantian as Reid Hoffman. Their morality is, instead, a complicated question. Sometimes we can trust these plutocrats, sometimes we can't. Some, like Amazon founder and CEO Jeff Bezos, who at the time of writing has a net worth of $83 billion, making him the second richest person on Earth, after Bill Gates, are simultaneously cutthroat businessmen and selfless philanthropists. On the one hand, Bezos is the much-feared leader of a semi-monopolistic e-commerce company that has highly questionable labor practices and a well-documented history of bullying publishers. On the other, he's the public-spirited owner of the venerable Washington Post, and under a Trump regime that has castigated journalists as enemies of the people, among America's most powerful defenders of both a free press and democracy. In June 2017, Bezos tweeted a request for ideas for philanthropy. "I'm thinking about a philanthropy strategy that is the opposite of how I mostly spend my time, working on the long term. For philanthropy, I find I'm drawn to the other end of the spectrum, the right now," he hinted about his philanthropic plans. "If you have any ideas," Bezos concluded with typical quirkiness, "just reply to this tweet." To take another example, Mark Benioff, the swaggering Henry VIII look-alike CEO of the business software provider Salesforce.com, though a remarkably generous supporter of many noble social causes, remains perhaps a little too enamored with attaching his name to public projects, such as the UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital in San Francisco. Then there's Tim Cook, the Apple CEO, whom we last met in Margrethe Vestager's Brussels office, trying to convince the EU commissioner that the 0.005% tax his company paid to the Irish government was somehow in the public interest. Yet that's the same Tim Cook who has been outspoken in his defense of immigration and minority rights, and in his critique of the corrosive impact of fake news on our political culture. Yes, it's complicated. As the Financial Times' John Thornhill notes, today's tech billionaires have publicly stated ambitions way beyond making money, and are extending their reach into areas such as transport, health, and education. For all their all-too-human shortcomings, Cook, Benioff, and Bezos are exceptionally smart, and in some ways, responsible people, who, with Bill Gates and a handful of other tech tycoons, are emerging as the philanthropic Carnegies, Stanfords, Rockefellers, Vanderbilts, and Fords of the early 21st century. Let's also not forget Mark Zuckerberg, who in December 2015 committed to giving away 99% of his wealth within his lifetime. Like Gates or Zuckerberg, the robber barons of the 19th century weren't exactly paragons of virtue. Take, for example, the California railroad tycoon, Leland Stanford, who also became the governor of California and a U.S. senator. Before the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, there were the Big Four, the four 19th century Northern Californian magnates behind the Central Pacific Railroad: Mark Hopkins, Charles Crocker, Collis Huntington, and Stanford himself. A master of the dark arts of political deal-making and bribery, Stanford exploited the monopolistic economies of scale of the Central Pacific Railroad to become one of America's wealthiest transportation magnates. And his business partner and fellow Big Four member, Charles Crocker, successfully starved out striking Chinese railroad laborers who were doing the dangerous work that no one else would do. Yet Stanford also bestowed one of the largest endowments ever on a private university when he donated 8,800 acres of his own ranch lands and farms to set up a new college in Palo Alto. Tech-focused from the start, Leland Stanford Junior University opened tuition-free in 1891 and has nurtured generation after generation of entrepreneurs: Bill Hewlett and David Packard, the founders of Hewlett-Packard, and the founders of the Silicon Valley financial and technological ecosystem, graduated in the 1930s. And since then, Stanford's Office of Technology Licensing has supported such innovations as data analytics, recombinant DNA, and the Google search engine. The Microsoft co-founder and longtime CEO, Bill Gates, is in some ways the modern reincarnation of Stanford. Having become the richest man in the world in the first half of his life through the use of often unscrupulous and sometimes illegal methods of crushing his rivals, he has spent the second half of his life giving away his billions to those less fortunate than himself. Today, Gates has become what David Callahan, the editor of the Inside Philanthropy website and the author of the 2017 book The Givers, calls a super citizen of the new Gilded Age. A philanthropist so powerful that he is often able to shape the education, healthcare, and economic policies of governments around the world. Technology tycoons seem to be gradually replacing aging oilmen as the heavy lifters of largesse, notes Financial Times' Anjana Ahuja. And Gates is the heaviest lifter of them all, a man who, like his friend Warren Buffett, is determined to give away all his money before he dies. And, as Callahan points out in The Givers, Bill Gates and his Gates Foundation have become the model for the disruptors, a new generation of young tech super citizens, including Facebook billionaires like the company's former president, Sean Parker, its co-founder, Dustin Moskovitz, and Mark Zuckerberg himself. So how should today's tech billionaires be giving away their money? What makes a good Silicon Valley super citizen in our new Gilded Age? It's complicated. It's certainly complicated. Just as whole books have been written about the morally complex philanthropy of the Stanfords, Carnegies, Rockefellers, and Vanderbilts, so a book should, and no doubt will, be written about Mark Zuckerberg's much-publicized and highly controversial commitment to the public good. Yes, in 2015, the 31-year-old Zuckerberg and his wife, Priscilla Chan, to great public fanfare, committed to donating a breathtaking 99% of their then $45 billion wealth to charity. Later, it became clear that their fortune will be put into a limited liability company that isn't even officially considered a charity by the IRS, thus allowing them to invest their money in for-profit businesses at a low tax rate. So, for example, the $600 million that Chan invested in BioHub, a scientific research organization employing some of the best researchers at Bay Area universities, would allow her to own the intellectual property it develops around vaccines and drugs for infectious diseases like HIV and Zika, and she would also, in theory, profit from its sale. As the Financial Times' Edward Luce explains, Zuckerberg, as an aspiring super citizen, has pulled off something remarkable. He has ensured that he will pay no tax on transfer of his estimated $45 billion in wealth while being showered with accolades for giving it all away. Then there's the 6,000-word mission statement Zuckerberg laid out in February 2017, in which he announced Facebook's commitment to solving many of the world's problems, including the economic crisis of the local news industry. Some have interpreted this essay as a prelude to Zuckerberg's entry into politics. Perhaps, like Leland Stanford, he will one day become a California governor or a senator. Zuckerberg certainly already possesses Stanford's moral ambiguity. As Stephen Waldman, the former advisor to the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, notes, Zuckerberg's long-winded mission statement, much of which is a thinly veiled advert for the supposedly ethical utility of Facebook, failed to take responsibility for Facebook's central role in this crisis and failed to donate the resources to solve it. Waldman contrasts Zuckerberg with the steel magnate Andrew Carnegie. The 19th century robber baron Andrew Carnegie gave away most of his wealth later in life. Carnegie built almost 3,000 libraries. All Mark Zuckerberg, Larry Page, Sergey Brin, and Laureen Powell, widow of Steve Jobs, have to do is fund 3,000 journalists, Waldman observed. If the leaders of these companies put the equivalent of just 1% of their profit for 5 years to the cause, local American journalism would be transformed for the next century. Waldman is right to use Carnegie, the author of the influential 1889 article, The Gospel of Wealth, a kind of Moore's Law pamphlet for the rich that called on them to invest their wealth in improving society as a role model for our 21st century tech barons. In business, Carnegie was anything but an angel. His steelworks were the sites of some of the most violent labor clashes of the late 19th century. After a long history of union busting in their factories, his partner, Henry Clay Frick, even hired an armed militia in 1892 to put down a strike at the Homestead, Pennsylvania site. The confrontation resulted in the deaths of 18 people. And yet, after his retirement, Carnegie dedicated himself to giving away almost all his wealth during his lifetime, a gospel taken up today by Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg. This self-educated and self-made steel mogul actually helped finance more than 2,500 free public libraries in his lifetime, including libraries in San Francisco and Oakland, as well as Palo Alto's first public library building, opened in 1904. When Carnegie died in 1919, he had given away about $350 million, some 90% of his wealth, to charities, foundations, schools, and libraries, a sum that would be worth almost $4.8 billion today. But rather than how much, it's how Carnegie gave away his money that should be so instructive for today's tech billionaires. As his Gospel of Wealth piece argued, it was the duty of the wealthy to improve society. They have it in their power during their lives to busy themselves in organizing benefactions from which the masses of their fellows will derive lasting advantage and thus dignify their own lives, he wrote about the responsibility of the rich man to help those less fortunate. With great power, Carnegie strongly believed, comes great responsibility. His massive investment in libraries captured this sense of social responsibility. First, by financing so many free public libraries around America, he was investing in his fellow citizens so that they could, as he had done, as a young Scottish immigrant, make something of themselves by educating themselves. His libraries, he said, were designed for the industrious and ambitious, not those who need everything done for them, but those who, being most anxious and able to help themselves, deserve and will be benefited. Second, Carnegie was investing in communities and in public space. His strategy was to provide the capital, as long as the local authorities matched his money, by providing the land and the necessary budget to staff and operate the library. One of his greatest legacies, then, was a collection of urban architectural monuments.
from Baroque to Spanish Renaissance to Italian Renaissance, that now grace many American downtowns. What is missing from the philanthropy of most tech billionaires today is a similar kind of civic engagement. Yes, there is a kind of arms race of giving going on right now, with these billionaires competing to see who can give away the most money. But rather than borrowing the Carnegie model of investing money thoughtfully in the improvement of society, much of today's tech philanthropy seems to simply reflect the particular enthusiasm of the donor or the donor's spouse. Having frittered away $500 million in a wasted investment in New Jersey schools, Mark Zuckerberg, for example, seems to have settled on investing $3 billion of his wealth in the Herculean effort to cure, prevent, and manage all disease. Jeff Bezos, in contrast, is an avid space colonialist, who even has a plan to set up an Amazon-like delivery service for future human settlements on the moon. And Google co-founder Sergey Brin is investing between $100 million and $150 million in building the world's biggest aircraft to deliver supplies for humanitarian missions. It will, however, also be designed to serve as a luxurious intercontinental air yacht for Brin's friends and family. Andrew Carnegie, no doubt, would be turning in his grave at such an indulgent use of valuable resources. So, how should Brin, Bezos, and Zuckerberg be investing their money in society? Perhaps they should adopt General Colin Powell's famous, "You break it, you own it" view of war. That check to support the 3,000 journalists, which Stephen Waldman says is essential to save local American news, should probably come from Brin, whose search engine has played a central role in undermining the business model of traditional newspapers. And Brin, whose company, you'll remember, is even trying to privatize geography through its Dominant Map software, might replicate the work of Andrew Carnegie and invest part of his fortune in the creation of public space. But while Carnegie invested his wealth in the physical architecture of downtown libraries, Brin should figure out how to create digital public space where our privacy is guaranteed and there is no advertising. That shouldn't be too hard for him. After all, it was the original vision of Google when he and Larry Page created their search engine as Stanford graduate students in 1998. Rather than funding interplanetary travel, Jeff Bezos should invest his money in figuring out how to employ people in an automated future, which Amazon, with its billions of dollars of investment in delivery drones and robot-operated fulfillment centers, is pioneering. This will be the greatest question of the 21st century, and Bezos has both the financial resources and the intellectual discipline to confront this astonishingly complex issue. I sense that Bezos is only now really breaking into his stride as a public figure. Like Steve Jobs, he is a man of superhuman ambitions and abilities. With Apple, Amazon, which Jeff Bezos founded in 1994, remains the most remarkable American company of the last half century. But if Bezos wants to be remembered by future generations, he should worry about jobs rather than e-commerce. Building the everything store is one thing. Fixing the future is quite another. So that's my tweet to Bezos about where he should put his philanthropy. Make sure we all have jobs in the future, Jeff. Easy. Instead of throwing billions of dollars into quixotic ventures that will supposedly let us live forever, Mark Zuckerberg would be better off trying to confront the global problem of technological behavioral addiction, the Facebook hook and Instagram hook that the New York University psychologist Adam Alter argues are shrinking our attention span to less than that of a goldfish. Zuckerberg might, for example, invest some of his time and resources in Tristan Harris's nonprofit movement, Time Well Spent, with its commitment to introducing a new Hippocratic Oath for software developers against the invention of addictive apps like Facebook, Snapchat, and Instagram. In July 2017, Reid Hoffman and his friend, Mark Pincus, the co-founder of the online game developer Zynga, introduced a new group to hack the Democratic Party called Win the Future, WTF. Their goal, according to the online tech website Recode, is to force Democrats to rewire their philosophical core
from their agenda to the way they choose candidates in elections. But WTF puts the cart before the horse. Rather than introducing the Silicon Valley culture of creative destruction into politics, Hoffman and Pincus should be focusing their resources on taking responsibility for the disruptive impact of technology on society. I've already suggested that Jeff Bezos should invest some of his stratospheric wealth in figuring out what jobs people will do in an automated future. And it would also be wise for Silicon Valley notables like Reid Hoffman and Mark Pincus to work closely with conventional politicians, like the Lieutenant Governor of California, Gavin Newsom, who, you'll remember, is now openly warning about the tsunami of unemployment and inequality set off by the digital revolution. The you break it, you own it model is already being pioneered by one of Silicon Valley's most responsible tech philanthropists. In 1995, a former IBM programmer named Craig Newmark founded Craigslist to enable Bay Area people to freely buy and sell local services and products on the Internet. Today, the site, which is valued at more than $1 billion, covers 20 countries and services 20 billion page views per month. Yet Craigslist, by giving away free local listings to its users, unintentionally undermined the classified advertising business model of local newspapers. Newmark's response to this disastrously unintended consequence of Craigslist's success has been to invest part of his wealth in a foundation to help journalism reinvent itself in the digital age. In December 2016, for example, his Craig Newmark Foundation invested $1 million to fund a university chair in journalism ethics. And Newmark's foundation is also a contributor, with John Borthwick's BetaWorks and Zuckerberg's Facebook, to be fair, to a $14 million fund at the City University of New York, run by the prominent journalism professor Jeff Jarvis, that is dedicated to fighting fake news by increasing trust in journalism. I'm not sure that Newmark would approve of Andrew Carnegie's rather unforgiving self-help doctrine, but he nonetheless shares Carnegie's commitment to reinvest his wealth back in society. F. Scott Fitzgerald famously wrote that there are no second acts in American lives, but he couldn't have been more wrong about the lives of successful tech entrepreneurs. What's needed in Silicon Valley are more Craig Newmarks willing to invest the second acts of their lives in down-to-earth schemes to win the future. The View from Nowhere. Looking to escape from Silicon Valley's out-of-control rents and endemic traffic problems, many Bay Area residents have fled over the Bay Bridge to Oakland, the industrial port that is now transforming itself not only into the Bay Area's liveliest city, but also, perhaps, into its conscience. There's no there there, the early 20th century American writer Gertrude Stein famously said about her hometown of Oakland, the inchoate industrial port over the bay from Silicon Valley. You'll remember Hugh Price's philosophical quest to find Archimedes' point and its authoritative view from nowhere, that vantage point from where one can not only objectively observe the world, but also change it. The perspective from early 21st century Oakland might represent that view from nowhere. It's just about the ideal spot, not only for getting an honest take on Silicon Valley, but also for beginning to build a more socially responsible alternative ecosystem of investors, technologists, and startups. When I first came to the East Bay in the early 80s to study at UC Berkeley, much of Oakland, especially the ravaged downtown area, around the old Paramount Theater on Broadway, the 3,500-seat Art Deco movie house that finally closed in 1970, was like a war zone, with burned-out buildings, boarded-up stores and offices, derelict industrial factories, and crime-infested streets. Today, however, Oakland's downtown is being reinvented in the same way that Estonia and Singapore transformed themselves from sleepy backwaters into global hubs of digital innovation. Innovative new businesses, people, and ideas are reinventing this decayed industrial shell into one of the most connected cultural and economic spots in America. But in Oakland, unlike other parts of the San Francisco Bay Area, especially Silicon Valley, not everyone moving in wants to become a tech billionaire. Today, the area around the Paramount, now renamed the Uptown neighborhood, is buzzing. The palatial old theater, which when first built in 1931, was the largest movie house on the West Coast, has been reinvented as the non-profit home of the Oakland East Bay Symphony and the Oakland Ballet. This uptown area, which is also home to Andrew Carnegie's original turn-of-the-20th-century Oakland Library, now transformed into the African American Museum and Library, is packed with hip restaurants, factory-style lofts, tech startup zones, and all the other accoutrements of successful urban regeneration. It's certainly a long way from the 16th-century Hall of Cambridge University's Trinity College, with its Renaissance features that have barely changed in 500 years, to this part of downtown Oakland with its almost complete reinvention over the past decade. One of the most impressive examples of this revival lies a couple of blocks north of the Paramount, on the corner of Broadway and 22nd Street, in a restored three-story building that, perhaps more than any other single building in the Bay Area, is charting a realistic map to fix the future. Between 1920 and the end of the 20th century, this building was just another anonymous office block in a decaying part of a forgotten city. But in 2012, the vacant building was acquired by two of tech's most innovative thinkers and transformed into the beginnings of a new tech ecosystem that could turn out to be as socially valuable today as Carnegie's libraries were in the late 19th century. In The Internet is Not the Answer, I wrote about a four-story private club in downtown San Francisco called The Battery that, in spite of its boasts of inclusivity and openness, is actually a nauseatingly exclusive gentleman's-style retreat for a tech elite of mostly rich white young men. The four-story reinvented building over the bay in downtown Oakland is everything that The Battery claims to be but isn't. Created by Mitch Kapoor, the founder of the software giant Lotus, which was acquired in 1995 by IBM for $3.5 billion, and his wife, Frida Kapoor Klein, a longtime tech activist and reformer, it is part venture capital firm, part non-profit hub for tech activists, part resource for local students and aspiring business people, and part inclusive community center, restaurant, and cafe. The 4,500-square-foot building, which opened in July 2016, after a two-year redesign project that totally gutted the old office block and transformed it into an airy four-story workspace designed by its architects to blend high-tech and humanism, is the home of the Kapoor Center for Technology and Social Impact. It houses all three of Mitch and Frida Kapoor's Tech for the Social Good initiatives, Kapoor Capital, the Kapoor Center for Social Impact, and the Level Playing Field Institute. None of these initiatives are new. The Center for Social Impact is a 10-year-old non-profit organization designed to attack social and economic injustice through mostly Oakland-based initiatives to increase diverse tech startups, improve access to capital, and improve STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, education. The Level Playing Field Institute is a pipeline program established by Frida Kapoor Klein in 2001 and designed to funnel underprivileged local kids through its Oakland-based Summer Math and Science Honors Program, SMASH, into tech firms. And Kapoor Capital is a seed-stage investor in both for-profit and non-profit tech startups. Between 2015 and 2017, it has already invested $40 million in education that focuses on improving access for minorities. 44 of these 79 investments, 59%, have a founder who is a woman or a person of color. 42% of their first-time investments have a female founder, and 28% have a founder who is a member of a racial minority, in contrast with all too many Silicon Valley startups that have no clear benefit to the broader community. All of Kapoor Capital's investments have a social purpose. There's Pigeonly, for example, founded by the formerly incarcerated Frederick Hudson, which helps inmates make calls from prison. There's Fat Startup, a company focused on helping young inner-city people who identify with urban culture succeed in developing technology careers. Then there's the senior care startup, Honor, and Benestream, a healthcare tech company that helps employees navigate the bureaucratic complexities of the Affordable Care Act. Together, these three parts of the Kapoor network have been set up as an East Bay counterweight to Silicon Valley's mostly corrosive indifference to the impact of its disruption on the world around it. You know that on the other side of that bridge, there are startups trying to solve the problems of the rich. We aim to make sure that Oakland becomes the place that is the center of solving the problems for the rest of us, noted Kapoor Capital partner Ben Jealous, the former CEO and president of the NAACP, and one of America's leading thinkers on technology, politics, and business. We're here to make sure that as Oakland becomes more tech, tech becomes more Oakland. On the sunny December 2016 morning when I visit the new Kapoor Center on Broadway in uptown Oakland, its front door onto the street is plastered with a quote from the new California Senator, Kamala Harris. Oakland, and indeed all of the Bay Area, is still reeling from the election of Donald Trump a month earlier, so there's a need for a reminder that the world hadn't actually ended on November 8, 2016. We must not be overwhelmed or throw up our hands. It is time to roll up our sleeves and fight for who we are, proclaimed the quote from Harris. Inside the Kapoor Center, that fight is raging. Kapoor Capital is hosting a hackathon for tech startups focused on the creation of jobs for the underprivileged. The theater in the basement of the new building is full of young tech entrepreneurs, and Kapoor management, including Mitch Kapoor, Ben Jealous, Frida Kapoor Klein, and their latest partner, the venture capitalist, Ellen Powell, who in 2015 fought a high-profile gender discrimination suit against the Silicon Valley blue-chip firm Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield, and Byers. By the way, that's the firm that was co-founded by the late Tom Perkins, the notoriously insensitive billionaire tech investor who, in a 2014 letter to the Wall Street Journal, explicitly compared progressives to Nazis. The $100,000 Kapoor Center hackathon is won by a young woman from Chicago called Tiffany Smith, an MBA student at Northwestern University. Smith has a for-profit startup called Tiltus, which is an online networking platform designed to connect the 650,000 people who come out of prison each year, whom she calls the formerly incarcerated, with job opportunities. Smith, who already is running a pilot program in a prison facility on the west side of Chicago, told me that she was inspired to start Tiltus by the experience of incarcerated friends who had found it impossible to get work after their release. Other entrants in the hackathon included an app designed to remove bias from hiring decisions, a platform that enables employers to create a diverse applicant pool for new jobs, a suite of tools helping startup founders provide truly fair compensation to their employees, and a mobile platform connecting traditional businesses with independent labor to fill hourly paid shift work. After the hackathon, I meet with Frida Kapoor Klein, who, with her husband Mitch, has emerged as a kind of de facto spokesperson of the opposition to the Gilded Age excesses of Silicon Valley. The conscience, if you like, of the revolution. As an early investor in Uber, for example, she has been very vocal in her critique of Uber's controversial treatment of its female employees. In February 2017, after a female former Uber engineer wrote a widely read blog post exposing the systemic sexism and sexual harassment at the company, Kapoor Klein, with her husband Mitch, even penned an open letter to the Uber board and investors, which went viral on the internet, about what they called the toxic culture of the rideshare startup. And after revelations about 500 Startups CEO, Dave McClure's systematic sexual harassment of female entrepreneurs, Mitch Kapoor, a limited partner in one of the 500 Startups investment funds, publicly stated his intention to ask for his money back from the fund. Tech must change, the influential TechCrunch journalist Josh Constein wrote about the corrosive culture at Uber And more people like the Kapoors must stand up for that change. Kapoor Klein, who never seems to appear in public without her dog Dudley, tells me that she grew up in Los Angeles in an activist family and went to UC Berkeley in the early countercultural 70s. In 1984, she went to work at Lotus, where her job description was to create the most progressive employer in the United States. At Lotus, she co-founded an investigative group on sexual harassment, the first of its type in the United States. And she was behind Lotus's sponsorship of an AIDS walk in 1984. Lotus was the first U.S. corporation to associate its brand with the fight against AIDS. I asked her what happened between 1984 and 2016 in tech to make the creation of the Kapoor Center so necessary. Many steps forward, she acknowledges, and a couple of huge steps back. Those huge steps, she says, include what she calls Silicon Valley's remarkably self-serving faith that it's a perfect meritocracy. Nobody in Silicon Valley, she says, recognizes his own incredible luck in happening to find himself in the wealthiest bubble in human history. A little humility would go a long way, she says about those young, privileged men like Sam Altman on the other side of the bay. There's also a complete lack of empathy in Silicon Valley, she says, particularly a failure of the almost exclusively white male executives to take responsibility for the unintended consequences of the tech boom, especially the income disparity, the homelessness, and the economic dislocation of a predominantly minority population that is transforming the San Francisco Peninsula into a 19th century tableau of shockingly explicit inequality. I ask her what distinguishes her and Mitch from the other plutocrats of Silicon Valley. They've obviously invested tens of millions of dollars in the Kapoor Center, but it's more than the money. After all, Mark Zuckerberg had, in theory at least, given $45 billion of his personal wealth to charity. And every Silicon Valley tech notable, even Travis Kalanick, the Randian former CEO of Uber, talks a good game when it comes to respecting the rights of minorities and women. But what Kapoor Klein is doing in Oakland, particularly in terms of the networks the Kapoor Center is building with the local community, seems so much more genuine than Zuckerberg's meretricious altruism. Why should I trust you? I ask. We haven't lost sight of where we've come from, and we've put ourselves in different circumstances, Kapoor Klein says about their commitment to this ambitious project. She explains that they've moved from their expensive home in San Francisco's exclusive Pacific Heights to a condo in Oakland's Jack London Square, only a mile away from their Broadway office. Trust us, she is saying. And I do trust her. Certainly more fully than I trust Sergey Brin, Jeff Bezos, or Mark Zuckerberg. What Frida Kapoor Klein, Mitch Klein, Ben Jealous, Ellen Pao, and their team are doing in establishing the Kapoor Center, setting up Kapoor Capital, and investing in socially valuable tech startups like Tiffany Smith's Tiltus is immensely valuable. The future, of course, can't be fixed overnight. But the Kapoor Center is seeding a new kind of East Bay countercultural explosion against a new American ruling caste, mostly lacking in empathy or responsibility. The center is helping to establish the foundations of an alternative innovation ecosystem to Silicon Valley. Kapoor Klein told me that her Smash Summer program has already graduated 13 consecutive classes of low-income and disadvantaged kids who all went on to attend college. Other alternative innovation networks are also emerging in Oakland with the goal, in Mitch Kapoor's words, to do tech differently. These include Hack the Hood, a group that prepares low-income youth of color for a career in tech by hiring them to build small websites, and Black Girls Code, which is focused on improving the STEM skills of young women. In February 2017, the Kapoor Center, along with the city, launched an Oakland startup network to support Oakland-based tech entrepreneurs. This initiative won the backing of the prestigious Kauffman Foundation, which is working to establish Oakland as a model for diverse entrepreneurship and provide other communities with a replicable program. What's emerging in 2017, Oakland, is the beginnings of an ethical tech movement that will contrast vividly with what's going on over the bay in Silicon Valley. It's similar to the leading role played by the neighboring East Bay city of Berkeley in the emergence of a healthier food economy during the 70s and 80s. Food in post-war America, you'll remember, was mostly processed, uniform, and unhealthy.